Who are you and what are you doing here?
Hi, everybody.
Well, what are we waiting for?
This is fantastic.
Hello, hello, hello.
This will only hurt for 22 minutes.
It's very early. I may have to hurt you. Call me in 5 minutes.
This is something that is treatable. This is something that is fixable.
Hey, this is not a test.
Oh, my God, it's early.
She'll be putting together a mosaic of voices from the arts, pop culture, personal growth, and justice. How are ya? Going to get down to business early today as we take on the war on drugs with professor and author Alexandra Chasen. She's compiled a very fascinating book that talks about how it all started and why it's so important to remember it today. Alexandra, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Amy Beth. Great to be here.
Good to have you here. So talk to us a little bit about your book and why you started it. Now, what drew you to this subject?
I actually started it almost 20 years ago when I was teaching a class about the U.S. prison industrial complex. And to me, the salient feature was the population of our prisons, which is disproportionately composed of young African American and Latino men who are doing time for minor nonviolent drug offenses. I was curious how we arrived at such a situation, and so I went to do some research on the origins of the war on drugs.
Fascinating. And then you decided, you found out, because a lot of people believe that it was Richard Nixon who started the whole darn thing. You found out that it really was, in fact, happened decades earlier. Talk to us about the character that you uncovered, as you credit with the guy that started the whole war on drugs.
Yes. So Nixon did a very highly visible campaign and is thought to have coined the phrase war on drugs, and that was in the early 1970s. But in fact, the mainstays of the war on drugs that Nixon seems to have launched in the early 1970s were all in place at least 20 years earlier and were, I think, being set up at least 20 years before that. So those principles are harsh penalties for drug offenders, compound penalties for repeat offenders, and mandatory minimum sentencing. And those go back at least as far as the early 1950s and the establishment of the Boggs Act. So that put in place those legal mechanisms, which were imagined as deterrents. And in some ways, we still imagine them as deterrents. They don't, in fact, function as deterrents. But as I say, by 1950, those were already in federal law. But I believe that the person who's really responsible for the war on drugs came into public office in 1930. His name was Harry J. Anslinger. He was the first commissioner of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, which was established in 1930, and he was in that job until 1962. So he was really up the middle of the 20th century. This guy was in that office crafting drug policy and drug law based on the principles of prohibition. And that principle, prohibition, precedes even Anslinger's entrance into office and persists. It was reinvigorated with the Boggs Act in the 1950s. It was reinvigorated with Richard Nixon in the early 1970s. But what we still have is essentially prohibitionist drug policy and drug law in this country. And I believe that Harry Anslinger is the person who's responsible for that.
That's the legacy. And, of course, you know, there's a lot of talk over the last couple of years, and certainly it came up during the election. It's kind of been back burner due to other events right now. But the idea of the whole criminalization of addiction, and we have a big opioid addiction problem in this country, and these very punishing incarceration rates and lengthy sentences with the mandatory minimums. There's always talk on really both sides of the aisle of really curtailing that, changing it, going back into more of a therapeutic model that, you know, addiction is a disease, not to be criminalized. Yeah. But we have decades of lives and generations of families that have been wrecked by some of these laws, and people with, you know, minor pot busts doing time. And certainly when in New York State they had the Rockefeller drug laws, which I think have been eased a little bit. I'm not sure if they've been completely overturned. It just seems so punishing, and we're finally opening our eyes to this. And, of course, there's also how it has been particularly hard on minority communities. People of color are particularly brushed by the crack cocaine versus white powder cocaine and all those debates that
right,
are going
absolutely.
On. So, you know, you do take that on as well. It's an interesting book, though, because you have this, you call it a kaleidoscopic history. You do play with form. I notice that a lot of your work is kind of experimental or semi-experimental, where you try to you do fiction as well in that kind of vein. How did you decide to say, well, I'm going to take on a heavy-duty cultural history, but I'm going to play with it a little bit in terms of the genre and the form of it?
Yeah, well, that has a lot to do with the content. So what you're saying is absolutely right. The war on drugs has had devastating effects on individuals and on whole communities, and I don't think of that as an incidental byproduct. I end by thinking of that as the thing that maintains the popularity and durability of a program that fails to meet its own stated goals decade in and decade out. The prohibitionist approach has not really reduced drug traffic or consumption, far from eliminating it. And the problems that it brings were all known during the period of alcohol prohibition, which immediately preceded Anslinger's entry into office. And so, of course, as you point out, one of the main problems with a prohibitionist approach to alcohol or drugs is that it's an impediment to a public health approach. To make this a matter of criminal justice is a huge deterrent, a divergence of resources, a stigmatization, that all of which prevents people from getting treatment that they might need. The other costs of prohibition include massive loss of revenue. That was absolutely the case during alcohol prohibition and is still the case with drug prohibition. The inducement to corruption on the part of law enforcement officers, because of course it's a lot more lucrative to sell bootleg liquor or illegal narcotics than it is to be a law enforcement officer. There's no oversight of product, and so bad booze or bad drugs can do more health damage to people than is necessary. And so for all of these reasons, I think we already knew at the end of alcohol prohibition that prohibition itself was a doomed strategy, but we kind of transferred it to drugs. And I think in a way that the rehabilitation of alcohol cost us the stigmatization of certain narcotics. So this is the basic material that Anslinger deals with, is the criminalization of certain narcotics and of the people who are party to them. And he was considered a propagandist. He was especially good at linking particular social or immigrant groups with particular drugs, and he was able to work up a kind of social scare about drugs very effectively. So because he was what I think of as a disciplinarian, his job was to control and to enforce, it seemed to me that to write about him and his work really required doing something that was against the rules of the disciplines in which I had been trained. And so I didn't want to write a standard academic type of book, very scholarly, although, of course, I did a ton of research. There's like 600 footnotes. So in that way, it is a scholarly piece of work. But I didn't want to reproduce the kind of thinking that I think made Anslinger the kind of drug czar that he was. So mandatory minimum sentencing, for example, is something that ties the hands of judges and compels them to give harsher penalties than they might otherwise give. I wanted not to do minimum mandatory sentencing in my own work. And so the sentences are maximal. The sentences are poetic. The sentences exceed the kinds of strictures of my discipline of origin. And so the book takes this kind of poetic license as a way of rejecting not only the effects of the drug war, but the very kinds of thinking that produce it in the first place.
Fascinating. I like that. And probably something that Anslinger himself would not be too pleased with.
I think he's rolling in his grave.
And what does he take now? Because now, of course, besides the whole fight against the mandatory minimums, which is crazy making, as you said, I'm sure for judges, as well as for the public, and of course for the defendants, but now we have this push, and some states have legalized marijuana. You certainly have medical marijuana available in many states, legalized in general in several states. There's a push for that. There's also a pushback for some people who say that be careful because it's not regulated enough, and some of the strains of marijuana in particular are more potent than they were back in the Woodstock era, and you have to be careful about all of that. I mean, what's your take on that? Do you think it's okay to just, you know, let's just legalize it, it's out there anyway, or is legalizing it going to make regulation easier and better? Certainly there's taxation involved, so that could take crime out of it. But what's your take on that? I'm just curious.
I am for full legalization for a number of reasons, one of which is the models that I see in other countries where relative legalization does not, in fact, drive up the crime rate, as sometimes people fear that it will, and where it doesn't even significantly raise addiction rates or drug use rates. So I take a lot of comfort from those effects. Meanwhile, as you say, of course, it makes taxation possible, and it makes oversight possible. It makes it possible to regulate product and even to regulate labor practices. And one of the things that's almost never talked about is how the drug market, we talk about this in terms of legal markets, how CEOs make so much more money than the lowest paid workers. That is extremely true in the drug industry. And it would, in my opinion, be a good thing to have some regulation over that so that the people picking coca leaves were not so badly exploited, for example. So relative to marijuana, I think legalization is a good thing because I think all legalization would be a good thing. And I do think it matters how it's done. Actually, I don't know if you would have seen or your listeners would have seen an incredible short video made by Jay-Z about legalizing marijuana. It was particularly with respect to the California market. The California just voted in November for legalization, and they voted on a very smart law because it's a law that that allows for felons to establish dispensaries. One of the troubles with marijuana going legal is it's possible that the people who are poised to profit from that are essentially already capitalized businessmen. And it seems like it would be the kind of market that should have more equal access, and people with previous felony convictions are usually unable to open dispensaries. And so California took some pains to try to level the playing field a little bit there. So I'm very in favor of legalization of marijuana, and I would have said before November, in fact, I probably did say before November, that if California went, it was tantamount to federal legalization just because of the size of the economy in California. No longer sure it's a straight line because of our new administration.
Yeah.
I do think the cat's out of the bag. I don't think marijuana is going back in the baggie, but I'm not sure it's going to be a straight line because our current attorney general, as long as he remains in that office, has not promised not to enforce federal law. And where marijuana is going legal, of course, it's doing it in states on a state-by-state basis. But even if I am right and there's an overall arc toward marijuana legalization, which will eventually amount to or actually be federal law, it's still not going to put a dent in the prohibitionist structure of drug law. It's going to effectively reclassify marijuana as something a lot more like alcohol.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense. And of course, you're not necessarily saying you're in favor of legalizing all these drugs like heroin, et cetera. But decriminalizing it in some way makes sense to me because the idea again that we're punishing people for essentially an illness, and some of these drugs, I think you pointed out in your book too, were used obviously for medicinal purposes before they became illegal drugs way back when, and then things got out of hand, which is what happens now, where people take legal prescription drugs and then they get out of hand and then sometimes they go to the street drugs. So what's your take on that, and where are we? Because it's such a complicated issue, obviously, this whole opioid addiction epidemic that we find ourselves in the midst of.
Yeah, well, it's very interesting, and again, what I can contribute to that has something to do with the history behind it. So 102 years ago, something was passed called the Harrison Act. And the Harrison Act was a tax Act that was meant to require physicians to register and pay a very small administrative fee in order to be able to prescribe narcotics to patients. At that point, morphine, opium, heroin, cocaine were used as medical treatments. And what happened after the Harrison Act was passed was that within the following 12 years, I would say through to the late 1920s, there was a campaign of prosecutions of physicians. And two kinds of cases were very, very common. One was a case where a physician was prescribing huge amounts of narcotics to large numbers of patients, some of whom were fictitious, and was working in cahoots with pharmacists all over town. And that kind of physician was clearly dealing. But there was another kind of physician, and this kind of physician was also taken to court again and again and again, and that was the doctor who was prescribing what was called maintenance. That is, just giving a patient who was already habituated to a certain narcotic just enough narcotics to keep them from going through withdrawals. Prior to 1915, that was fairly accepted. It was also kind of accepted that there were what were called habitués. They were not addicts. They were not fiends. They were not seen as criminal or even morally tainted. But that began to change as physicians who were doing maintenance-level prescription got called into court again and again and again and again, because the question was, is that sound medical practice? The campaign overall seems to have scared doctors, slowly but surely seem to have scared doctors away from doing that kind of prescribing. But I do think of that as an important antecedent to what we have going on right now. That is, people have for a long time become habituated to medicines that are addictive in nature. And that is, as you say, what's happening right now, where people are prescribed certain kinds of drugs, they become habituated, and then they start looking to maintain that dependency illegally. Again,
or they go or they start doctor shopping and all that stuff first. You know, they try to, if they can afford it.
Well, yes, exactly, which is, you know,
make up
arguably
other symptoms to get other doctors that don't know they've been on it for X number of, you know, months or years, yeah.
Yes, absolutely. And you saw this again in the 19-teens and 20s of kind of similar dynamic. I think that, I mean, what interests me about it is partly the way we look at the drug world is very bifurcated. We have a completely legal, massive pharmaceutical drug industry. And then we have an also very, very large illegal drug market. And so what interests me is the way the legal market is feeding people into the illegal market. I don't mean to say this discompassionately. Obviously, the trouble with the situation is lots of people are suffering and too many people are dying. And that's really what's wrong with the situation. But we have also a complicated legal situation, because doctors turn out to be kind of a pivot point, things that start legal but turn illegal. And so what happens is people who are patients in good faith, legally being prescribed medications, are then being fed into an illegal market and also therefore criminalized.
The criminalizing part that's really tragic in so many ways, because, again, lives are ruined. And as you said earlier, the stigma attached to looking for help also takes over, and then it gets delayed, and sometimes it's too late to get help, or you wind up in
absolutely
years in,
I think, stigmatization, it's hard to, yeah, I agree totally. It's really hard to overestimate how harmful stigmatization is.
Are you hopeful that because there is such an epidemic and there are people and, frankly, politicians on both sides of the aisle who have talked about this and said, you know, we have to change the way we look at it and we have to put forth more effort towards treatment, is that something which you think is around the corner, or do you think it's still going to be pie in the sky for us to achieve?
I'm hopeful for some very bad reasons. I'm hopeful because I think that a lot of white people are afflicted. And I think whereas we have a drug war that is essentially designed to afflict people of color. You have an opioid epidemic in which white people are afflicted, and unfortunately, I think that that's likelier to draw a kind of remedial attention than the case where we are continuing to criminalize and afflict people of color around to illegal drug use.
I guess that's the double-edged kind of comment, but you're right. I mean, because a lot of things that you discuss in the book do talk about how there's this inherent racism and xenophobic aspect to all of this stuff that started way back when with Harry that continues to pervade the issue today. But on the other hand, however it happens, if we can get to a good place, I guess we could say that's a good thing to do. But you're right. Sometimes motivations are a little murky and not necessarily so kosher, but hopefully we'll get there. It's a fascinating book. It's an interesting way to look at it and probably more entertaining than your average scholarly book, so people shouldn't be intimidated by all the scholarship that went into it. And as you said, there were years of research in here, so it's not like some fluff piece that you just decided to write. So it's not, I don't want to minimize it, but you do take some liberties and play with it as well, which is an interesting undertaking. So congratulations on that.
Okay.
I know you're launching
one of the things
that go ahead.
I was going to say one of the things they did to try to keep that book fun, because drugs should be fun, really. They shouldn't be a matter of crime and danger. Therefore, don't use them, kids. One of the things that I did to keep the book fun was to try to base the whole story in a series of primary historical documents. There's a bunch of little chapters, and each chapter is a kind of elaboration or a comment on a different kind of historical document, whether it's a photo of the Coast Guard busting a rum runner or a title to certain land in Altoona, Pennsylvania, or statistics, or an article from a detective magazine from the 1940s. There's all kinds of, and that's also why I call it kaleidoscopic, because there are all these visual images. The war on drugs has taken place in so many different parts of our world, and life is covered by so many different kinds of disciplines, government agencies, and we have so many stories about drugs that I really wanted to show the kind of range of documents that have been in play around the war on drugs.
I think you did it quite well. Very inventive. It's an inventive approach for sure. Alexander Chasen, the book is Assassin of Youth, A Kaleidoscopic History of Harry J. Anslinger's War on Drugs. You can find out more details at your website. It's alexanderchasen.us. I'm going to post it along with the podcast when it becomes available. And as I said, you have listings of where you're going to be in terms of book signings, et cetera. So good luck with it. Congratulations. I know it was a lot of work, a lot of effort. And I think a lot of people will be appreciative of all of that. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Amy Beth. Great to talk to you.
Take care. Bye-bye. It is the Amy Beth Berkley Show. Reach out via Twitter as far as time permits. We have a little trouble with the stream today at AB Writes. And the phone line, if you can squeeze in, 347-857-4505. Stick around. timely. Not So Forgotten 45 from Brewer and Shipley for Bernie. One Toke Over the Line on the Indie Death Arc Week Show. Thanks again going out to Alexandra Chasen, professor and author of The Assassin of Youth, Kaleidoscopic History of Harry J. Anslinger's War on Drugs. Fascinating, inventive look on the war on drugs, its origins, and its cultural implications to this very day, ongoing as it is all these years later. We'll give you details. Her website will post it all for you when the podcast becomes available. And this is the podcast because our live stream at the BTR site had a glitch and a gremlin in it or two. So if you were listening live, you lost us, but you're listening on podcast now, I hope. So we'll keep it going for a few more minutes anyway. And we got some comments that came in over the transom during the live portion of the show via Twitter at AB Writes. Keep doing that 24/7, of course. The other stuff will just have to go by the wayside, unfortunately, today. Well, actually, Facebook and PopNet Chatbox, if we got them in, we'll get to them, of course. On Twitter, a lot of folks are chiming in about, well, a couple of folks chiming in about the interview. Let's talk about that first, and then we'll get to the comments about Trump and the Syrian airstrike. Leonora chiming in. Hey, great to have you live again. Good show. Good interview. Timely indeed. War on drugs still a big deal. Yeah, sure is. Fritz says, hey, good conversation. Like it, ladies. We'll check out the book. All right. It is alexanderchasen.us is the website to find out more about that book. On to Trump and the Syrian airstrike last night. Good, bad idea? I don't know. I mean, I know a lot of people were very upset about the images that we saw, this horrible chemical attack. People are dying. It's been going on, so many loss of life, young people, children, just average Syrian citizens who are looking. This is why we have this refugee crisis. This has been going on for years. Some people were very upset with President Obama when he drew the so-called red line and then didn't do anything about it, and that seemed like bluffing. Of course, Donald Trump, before he was president, was vehement that we shouldn't be involved in anything in Syria, was always yelling at Obama via his Twitter feed against it. But now that he is president, he's had to change his heart, he says. He was very taken aback by those images. These are not the first horrible images we've seen. But, you know, I don't know how to call it. Was it a good idea, not a bad idea? It was a warning shot, so to speak. Syria's up in arms. The Russians are up in arms. Was it done deliberately, some people say, to divert attention from the whole Russian thing or to make Trump appear to be strong against Putin? I don't know. I don't want to be that cynical because I don't know all the facts yet. I do know that a warning shot is one thing. A strategy is a whole other deal. Is there a strategy there? Are we going to finally remove Assad? He's horrible. But what happens then if we start playing regime change again? We've not had the greatest luck with that in the past. Is it a good idea? Not a good idea. I don't know. But a lot of people are up in arms about it or have opinions on it. Some people are think it was a good tactic. What's your take? We'll check out some of the folks that have already chimed in, because you can still chime in if you're listening to me on podcast, by the way. I just won't respond immediately. But AB Writes is the Twitter feed. And let's see what we have so far. A couple of folks chiming in. Here on Facebook, Chuck says, could Trump somehow have been involved with the chemical attack on Syria to cause a distraction from Russian collusion and attempt to make himself look, in his mind anyway, a badass in the process? Well, I don't know. That's what I was saying. Is it a possibility to divert attention away from his own scandals that he has to contend with, and also the fact that he wants to show that he is strong against Putin? But I don't know if that's just being cynical. The reality is this did happen. He didn't make Assad do what he did. At one point, they were kind of talking it down like, well, maybe Assad wouldn't. I think it was Steve Bannon who said Assad wouldn't do that. It's curious how this happened on the heels of Steve Bannon being removed from the National Security Council, too. I mean, there are all these intriguing machinations that are tangential to what happened. But you can't put the blame on Trump, how much you may abhor Trump, and you know I'm not a fan. I'm certainly no Trumpian, but you can't say that he made Assad do what he did. The question is, was the response a good one? It was certainly more measured than a full-out attack. You know, how far are we going to take it, I guess, is the next question. What is the long-term strategy? Is there one? But it's also not doing nothing, and some people were mad that Obama didn't do anything. I mean, what is the answer, and why now, though? Again, some people would ask, because this has been going on for a long time. It's just that these are new, fresh images that Trump has seen, to say that he's moved by it now. But he is president now, and he wasn't president when he was sitting behind, you know, closed doors just tweeting. I mean, he still does a lot of that, but he still now has the responsibility of being president, and we can't forget that. So I don't know. You know, I'm not sure where I stand on this, because I don't know what the answer is. I don't know what the end game is going to be. Assad should go. But how do we get him out of there? He should have gone years ago, but they didn't do anything about it because they didn't know what the answer would be. And just as of yesterday, you had Secretary of State Tillerson saying it's up to the Syrian people to get rid of him. So there you go. It's still murky in terms of the motivations and what we're going to do next. That's my take on it. What's yours? Again, on the Twitter feed, Cindy says, trouble ahead, Trump is looking for a dodge. Yeah, I'm not sure what that means. I guess, again, looking for cover on this topic. Well, I don't know. I don't know if I want to be that cynical about it, because I'm not so sure that's all there is to it. But we'll see. We'll try to watch it as it plays out, and it certainly is a tough go. He had a tough week before this happened, of course. We have the filibuster with the Supreme Court, which is going nowhere. Gorsuch will be confirmed, I guess, today with the nuclear option, and now that sets the question up for the Democrats, what's next for them? Was that a good or a bad move, too? Lots of people, we talked about this yesterday on social media, up in arms about that on both sides, saying it's not such a hot idea for the Democrats because now you're going to get even more conservative judges, perhaps. On the other hand, did they do the right thing because, again, as a symbolic gesture to Trump, to the Republicans, and, of course, appealing to their base of rabid progressives who say no way because he didn't go in Merrick Garland. So he had that to deal with. Healthcare up for grabs again, and the Russia scandal still looms large. And I don't think that's going away anytime soon, regardless of how contentious this relationship now between Trump and Putin may become because of the Syrian attack. I don't know. But I don't think it eradicates the investigation, certainly, or whatever happened before, and whether they had any kind of collusion or not, and whether it can be proven. All of those things still remain, and Trump is still going to have to deal with it. But perhaps, I know somebody suggested yesterday, some pundit, that perhaps somebody whispered in Trump's ear, because his approval rating has slipped into the low 30s, that you could get yourself another 7 to 10 points in approval just by showing some military might. Again, are we being cynical? Maybe. You know, it's a possibility. We might be. We might be being cynical. I don't know. Your take, few minutes left. We're going to wrap things up early because, again, I got to find out what's going on with these BTR gremlins, but I think the stream is working for the podcast, at least for now. So we'll check out a couple of those. Do we want to do this? Oh, let's do this. This will be fun. Speaking of streaming and all that comes with it. well, not Blondie, it's the Blondie parody. I mean, sorry, can we show you? Thinking about streaming, our live stream ended a lot earlier than expected, so I'm not sure how long we have on our tape stream, so we're going to wrap things up early today. I just do want to mention the passing of Mr. Warmth himself, the great late insult comic Don Rickles, passed away at the age of 90. Hockey pucks all over the world are mourning. He was a guy who invented the roast, I guess, and was politically incorrect till his dying day. Had a lot of fun and made a lot of people laugh. A lot of people enjoyed those live shows. They were in for it when they went, right, but they loved it. Don Rickles, age 90. He did what he wanted. He had a good life, that's for sure. And big news out of the music world, I guess it's big news, Barry Manilow officially telling People magazine that he is indeed gay, and he was married to his longtime manager a few years ago, which I thought I had heard back in 2014. I guess they didn't make a big deal about it, or he didn't speak about it publicly, but he said he never wanted to talk about it and come out because he thought he would disappoint his legions of mostly female fans over the years. He's 73 now. You know, when he came out, it was over 40 years ago, came on the scene, I should say, and it was a different deal, I know. So I'm glad people can be who they are now and admit their identities. So Mazel Tov, Barry Manilow, I knew you got married a few years ago. You didn't want to talk about it. Congratulations. Enjoy. Hey, we're going to wrap up here before we get kicked off officially and for good on this stream deal. We'll take a look at it, Trudy. Don't panic. But I thank you for joining us. Don't forget, you can do it 24/7 on Twitter at AB Writes. Follow our producer, Trudy Hart, on Twitter at Radio Trudy. Friend me on Facebook. We'll give you updates on the Radio Graffiti page. You can also hop over to my website, amybetharkawy.com. Easy access via the Twitter feed. And chime in with your guest suggestions. Big Story and Forgotten 45 requests. We'll get to those next show. Hopefully we'll do a coffee clutch next week. And lots of goodies lined up for you in that regard. You can check out the Eliza Gordon Mysteries and find out about creativity coaching, all of that good stuff at the website, amybetharkawy.com. Find out more about Alexandra Chasen and her book, Assassin of Youth, at alexandrachasen.us. We will publish that for you, too, on the Twitter stream along with our podcast. How about that? Follow the Amybeth Arkawy Show BTR site, Mixcloud, iTunes, NetNow, and select episodes on ARN and PopNet as well. So we'll leave you with Barry Manilow. Have yourself a great weekend. Whatever you do, wherever you go, drive safe, play nice, dream big. Hey, come back and see us, won't you? On the Amybeth Arkawy Show. It's not necessarily a miracle, but we have fun doing it. Take care. Thanks to the TCS crew.
My arms are around you. Baby, love is dancing in the